It was November 24th, 1992. Sonic Tuesday had finally arrived, and like Santa Claus on Christmas, he needed to stay jolly in order to bring good around the world. And there was no better place to spread this message of joy than from the place that most resembled Santa's workshop south of the North Pole, the mammoth Toys R Us in the heart of New York City's bustling Herald Square. Sega had taken over the back corner of Toys R Us to host what looked and felt like a political rally for Sonic the Hedgehog. Sonic himself was there to greet incoming fans, friends, and journalists, as was his huggable new sidekick Tails, on hand to compliment but never overshadow the Hedgehog. Both characters patrolled the perimeter of this rally, ushering guests towards a small stage where MTV's Adam Curry emceed the event. Standing behind a podium with a Hollywood-worthy poster for Sonic 2, and in front of a 30-foot, too-fast, too-cool, today banner, Curry revved up the crowd for this groundbreaking occasion. After building up momentum for Generation X's first unofficial holiday, he welcomed Sega's non-hedgehog man of the hour. And now to tell you more about all the exciting details as Sega of America's president and CEO, Tom Kalinske. As Kalinske walked onto the stage, the applause finally drove out of his mind any further musings about Sega of Japan. "Thanks, Adam," Kalinske said, taking his place. "This is a very exciting day for all of us at Sega. Today, we celebrate the official launch of Sonic the Hedgehog 2. Shinobu Toyota tried to pay attention to Tom's every word, but he was too overcome with pride. So when his boss said, "In the last 3 years, the video game business has grown by 60% to become a $4 billion a year industry," what Toyota heard was, "We did it." And when his boss said, "The reasons for this growth are largely due to Sega developing new technologies and games that make playing more exciting and more fun," what Toyota heard was, "Can you believe that we did it?" A little over 1 year ago, Yuji Naka had quit working for Sega. But Toyota had found a way to keep Sonic's creator happy, and that created a feeling of pride that he did not think would ever fully go away. To the outside world, convincing Naka that Sega of America was completely different from Sega of Japan may have appeared like nothing more than linguistic camouflage, but it really was much more than that. For many years, SOA was treated like little more than SOJ's errand boy. Although this dynamic may have spewed some unnecessary condescension, it wasn't all that far from the truth. SOJ created the concepts, the characters, and the games, and all SOA had to do was market and sell them. Okay, maybe marketing and selling to the 250 million people in the United States was not such a small thing, but it was more of a task than a tactical decision. This balance of power began to shift, however, when Tom Kalinske took over. It wasn't solely because of Sega of America's new CEO, although Nakayama's trust in his prestige went a long way. It also had to do with the confluence of people, plans, and pop culture. But most important, what Kalinske and his team did actually worked. And it worked in a way that it didn't in Japan. Those at Sega of Japan watching this play out were likely quick to call their American counterparts power-hungry. Although that may have been true to some extent, as humans tend not to prefer subservience, a better term to describe those at Sega of America would be success-hungry. Tom Kalinske did not take pride in lording it over SOJ's executives, nor did Al Nilsen earn his self-esteem by telling Japan's marketing team what they were doing wrong. In fact, both quite literally went the extra mile to avoid those things. Kalinske traveled to Japan every month or two, unlike his predecessor who only once went, and Nilsen often traveled with him, as well as constantly faxing over extensive marketing strategies, a kindness that was rarely, if ever, reciprocated. Although one could identify a small spectrum of possible motives for their behavior, kindness, respect, or just covering their asses, what made both men, as well as the rest of their SOA colleagues, always go that extra mile with SOJ was their hunger for success. In 1990, they had had a taste. In 1991, they started a food fight, and by November 1992, they were addicted. What had once seemed like a long shot was now actually working, and that only made them want to work harder because they couldn't bear the thought of losing this feeling. That's why Sega of America had fought so hard over seemingly petty details regarding Sonic 1990. And that's why they had been so meticulous in their attacks on the Super Nintendo 1991. And that's why they'd started developing their own games in the United States 1992. SOA was SOJ's errand boy no more. And that's why Shinobu Toyota had been able to persuade Yuji Naka to come to San Francisco and work with Mark Cerny and his team at the Sega Technical Institute. The cross-cultural development of Sonic 2 left a collaborative imprint on the sequel that would help position this title as the video game world's first true blockbuster. If creators from such different nations were both pleased with this game, then surely that universal appeal would translate to many of the countries between America and Asia. From the very first demo, Toyota had no doubt about the quality of this joint effort. But he did harbor concerns about the pace of Naka's quest for perfection. If Sega of America was serious about declaring a Sonic holiday in November, then Toyota needed to ensure that the game's development didn't spill into December, January, or February. This concern was part of the reason that SOA's executives had been so willing to greenlight Nilsson's latest so-crazy-it-might-actually-work plan. By selecting a Tuesday in November and then creating a media circus around that date, Naka would realize this was more than just an air-quote deadline. And if Naka hadn't fully understood what was at stake, Toyota hammered home the point in June when he personally delivered airline tickets to everyone on Naka's Sonic team. They would all be traveling to New York for Sonic Tuesday. So, if they didn't want to endure the greatest embarrassment of their lives, then they had better make sure the game was done on time. And it was, which made Toyota smirk with pride while respectfully nodding as Kalinske spoke at Toys R Us. "Today we have received word," Kalinske continued, "that Sonic 2 is already off to an incredibly fast start. The game has been on store shelves in the United Kingdom less than a day, and already it's sold 800,000 units. The process of coordinating this global launch had brought Sega of America and Sega of Europe, SOE, closer than ever. SOE embraced SOA's winner-go-home attitude and set up several launch events in major cities across Europe, highlighted by a pair of media pleasers in the United Kingdom. First, a fleet of London's famous double-decker buses were outfitted with Mega Drive systems and spent the day traveling to schools around the city. Next, Sonic hot air balloons were released throughout the day. These events, like those that Sega of America had arranged over the years, were designed as low-cost ways to attract an audience of more than just gamers, and each was also cleverly choreographed with an eye toward presenting media stories that would write themselves, i.e., Sonic balloons invade Britain. Although SOA tended to emphasize speed, technology, and alternative thinking, and SOE's marketing typically focused on positioning Sega as Europe's luxury video game brand, the Aston Martin to Nintendo's Vauxhall, Sonic Tuesday proved that they had more in common than they originally thought, and by working together, they could be more than the sum of their parts. "And I have just spoken to our folks in Japan," Kalinske said next, conscious not to grit his teeth as he cheered Sonic Tuesday's success in Asia. But it was a little hard to sport a smile, because for some reason, Sega of Japan had decided that Sonic Tuesday should not be on that Tuesday, as it was in every other country in the world. "Sonic is causing an equal frenzy in that country," Kalinske explained, "where the game has been available since Saturday." Kalinske may have been forced to smile, but Nilsson couldn't help but roll his eyes. A few weeks earlier, Sega of Japan had decided that they would prefer to release Sonic 2 on Saturday, November 21st. For someone trying to coordinate the world's first global launch, this sudden change of heart was frustrating. But more frustrating was the reason, or rather, the lack thereof. After 3 years of working at SOA, Nilsson had come to expect a certain level of veiled capriciousness from SOJ. He often found out about their real marketing and product development plans by poking through the shipment of Japanese video games that Shinobu Toyota received each week. But to do this with Sonic Tuesday, and to do it so close to the big day, that felt almost malicious. Someone driven by power might have threatened to dismantle Sonic Tuesday everywhere if Japan did not conform. But since Nilsson and his SOA colleagues were instead driven by success, they ignored SOJ's odd decision and focused on finding a way to make it fit into the larger narrative. Returning to the blockbuster analogy, they chose to spin Japan's Saturday launch as an exclusive sneak preview. For Kalinske, peddling this version of the truth to the media was no problem, but selling it to his employees was another story. That was the disheartening part. To have to look them in the eye and optimistically explain how this was actually a good thing. Sure, it would have been a lot easier to share in his employees' collective groan. But the problem with managing that way is that although the bad news is easier to swallow, it also inherently lingers longer. That's why Kalinske always walked around the office with a smile, saving the frowns for his own time. "We developed Sonic 2 to be the fastest video game in the world as well as the coolest," Kalinske continued. "Sonic has a new attitude, a new friend, and a whole set of new maneuvers. But rather than me tell you how gnarly they are, I've invited some pretty famous Sonic experts with us today who are anxious to give you their review of Sonic 2 and to describe the game features in greater detail. First up, from the NBC TV sitcom Saved by the Bell, is Dustin Diamond. Dustin, come on up here." Dustin Diamond ran on stage energetically, and when the moment was right, Kalinske stepped aside and let the geeky television star enjoy the limelight. In slow motion, Dustin Diamond's smile disappears, he stops waving to the crowd, and then he runs backward off the stage as Tom Kalinske moves back to the podium. "Keep rewinding for a few seconds," Ellen Van Buskirk said as she, Brenda Lynch, and a film editor reviewed footage of the presentation from a small news van parked in Herald Square. "I want to go back to when Tom starts talking about Japan. Less than a day, and already it's sold 800,000 units, Kalinske said on the video when the editor queued up the spot. "And I've just spoken to our folks in Japan. Sonic is causing an equal frenzy in that country." "All right, stop it there," Van Buskirk said, pausing the tape. "Do we want to use that as the lead-in for Dai's speech?" As requested, the film crew hired in Japan had given Lynch and Van Buskirk a lot of B-roll featuring excited kids buying Sonic 2. In addition to capturing that frenzy, they had also wanted some sound bites, which they received in the form of an interview with SOJ's Dai Sakurai at a special in-store video game competition.
"It's a good idea," Lynch said, "but I don't think we need it. As soon as Dai opens his mouth, it's clear that we're not in Kansas anymore. And all things being equal, I'd rather come in on the Sonic ring sound playing over Japanese teen shouting."
"Good point," Van Buskirk said. "All right, scratch that. Let's go back to Dustin Diamond playing the game and then get some stuff with the rest of the celebrities." Lynch and Van Buskirk were racing to finish what they believed to be the cornerstone of Sonic Tuesday, the International Video News Release, VNR. After the rally ended, they had only 30 minutes to cut together the VNR before it would be beamed via two satellites to every television newsroom in the United States. Outside of the United States, it would also be sent to every television news outlet in Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East via the Bright Star satellite, as well as to all of Asia through the Pan Am satellite. Because time was very much of the essence, they had crafted an overview of what the video should look like weeks in advance. This 26-point outline included things like opening scene of banners and window displays outside Toys R Us at Herald Square, number 3 on the list. Soundbite in English and then Japanese of a senior Sega executive talking about the excitement, number 14. And zoom out from London's scene setter of the double-decker bus crossing the Thames with Parliament in the background, number 22. Throughout the day, Lynch and Van Buskirk had been filling in most of their blanks with the footage they'd been receiving from around the world, but the whole VNR hinged on Tom Kalinske's keynote speech at Toys R Us in New York, and it was almost time to send his words around the globe.
"How's it going?" Al Nilsen asked, poking his head into the van.
"Fast," Lynch said as they scrolled through footage of Diamond playing Sonic 2. "That's an understatement," Van Buskirk added, pointing to the screen.
"Good," Nilsen said, squeezing into the van.
It was barely big enough for three, and certainly not big enough for a fourth of Nilsen's size. But in times of great stress, the Sega team worked as one, and under such circumstances, things like time, space, and physics momentarily seem not to matter very much.
"What do you have left?" "Number 5, Lynch said.
"Fast and furious action of the team stars playing games," Van Buskirk clarified. Building off the relationship forged at the Sega Star Kid Challenge television event, Sega had continued to work closely with many of Hollywood's youngest stars.
In addition to Dustin Diamond, the New York event featured a handful of other teen celebrities, including Joey Lawrence, Blossom, Jonathan Taylor Thomas, Home Improvement, and Michael Cade, California Dreams. Getting these stars to show up was easy. It was about maintaining a relationship and paying their appearance fee. But getting them to show up and not look foolish playing video games? Well, that was a different story. To teach them how to expertly play Sonic 2, or at least figure out which ones were better off just watching from the sidelines, Sega had hosted what amounted to a video game tutoring session the day before. Luckily, like most members of their generation, many of them were able to quickly learn how to play the game. A practice session may seem trivial, but it was important to Sega that these young celebrities give the impression that they really did love video games and weren't just heartthrobs for hire. "With Sega's blast processing capabilities," Diamond said while playing the game beside Kalinske on stage, "the galaxy's most famous blue dude with attitude is all new world, zones, music, and maneuvers, like the corkscrew, spin dash, sonic shield, and an unreal blue tube roller coaster run for head-on gold ring chasing fun." "Make sure you start with the blast processing," Lynch instructed the editor. "And let's mix that with some Joey Lawrence and call it a day," Van Buskirk said. "At least until the West Coast feed." In addition to the rally at Herald Square, Sega was also holding a similar event at the Toys R Us in Burbank, California. This West Coast event would be almost identical to the one in New York, except in Burbank, the keynote speech would be delivered by Ed Volkwine, would be emceed by Power 106 FM's George McFly, and would include a different roster of teen celebrities headlined by Saved by the Bell's Mario Lopez. But that wasn't for another few hours. All that mattered right now was New York. As Nilsson watched, applauded, and then approved the final video, Van Buskirk's mind took a short respite from traveling at a million miles per hour. "Wow," she thought. "Just wow." And like everyone else at Sega of America, she enjoyed a brief but exhilarating "we did it" moment before getting back to work and preparing for the next level. All this talk of the next level was becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. From a pure marketing standpoint, Bill White admired this very much. But from the standpoint of a vice president in Nintendo's marketing department, he was much less enthusiastic. For years, Nintendo had been foolishly allowing Sega to steal slivers of the market, but now they'd done more than that. They'd managed to steal Christmas. Well, not Christmas exactly. That was still a few weeks away. But they'd stolen something much more important than the anniversary of an immaculate conception and miraculous birth. Sega had stolen the Christmas shopping season. For the past 5 years, Nintendo had been marking its holiday territory with something called the North Pole Poll. What they did was hire the Gallup Organization, famous for their political polling data, and pay them to independently conduct a telephone survey of children around the country ages 7 to 16 and ask about what they wanted for Christmas. Every year the poll had been conducted, the most coveted item was always a video game system. And 1992 is no different, with 63% of kids starting off their Christmas lists with a plea for the newest video game system. What kind of video game system? Ha! Well, the survey didn't say, because in previous years the answer had been obvious. And this year, Nintendo was too afraid to ask. So instead of having Gallup ask the kids whether they preferred Sega or Nintendo, a separate survey of the country's retailers, the ones Nintendo was closest with, was conducted, and lo and behold, it forecasted that the Super Nintendo Entertainment System would be this year's hottest seller. And what's this? Amazingly, those same retailers forecasted that the best-selling game would be Street Fighter II. Sham or not, it didn't really matter. The purpose of the North Pole poll in this year's unsubstantiated survey of retailers was to get the story repeated over and over on the air, along with the words, "survey commissioned by Nintendo," and ideally some photos of the SNES, until it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. That had always been how it worked, but this year, Sega had crashed the party. On November 27th, the results of the North Pole poll went out to every media outlet around the country, and, like every year before, most ran the story. But this year, when the anchors talked about how every kid wanted Santa to bring them a new video game system, They used clips from the video news release that Sega had made for the new Sonic game. 63% of responding children said they really want a video game system for the holidays. They said over footage of Sonic hot air balloons. 54% want a portable video game system, was the statistic that went out over shots of teen celebrities playing Sega, and 43% want video games, was delivered over Tom Kalinske giving a speech at Toys R Us. The timing of Sonic Tuesday was no accident, and the way that Sega got that video played all around the globe, White would have called it brilliant if it weren't so damn infuriating. There was a time when Nintendo could have crushed the competition, but Arakawa had wanted to avoid stooping to that level. Well, now that both companies were virtually tied for market share, meeting Sega at their level would no longer entail stooping. This was certainly not what Bill White wanted for the holidays. But if this was what it took for Arakawa to wake up and start fighting back, then maybe the North Pole pole debacle was a Christmas miracle after all. A fairy tale future seemed to lie ahead for Nintendo's competitor, but beneath Sega's many mattresses of success was a nagging P-shaped question. Chapter 41. Fugu. What the heck is wrong with Sega of Japan? Tom Kalinske asked with a slow but determined shake of the head. Seriously, what is it with those guys? Kalinske was in Japan, having breakfast at Tokyo's Le Meridian Pacific Hotel with his favorite inside source at SOJ, Mike Fisher, one of the few and certainly the highest ranking of the Americans working at Sega of Japan. Although Fisher was only 27 years old, he'd impressed Nakayama with the sitcom-style wit, unpretentious intellectualism, and infectious enthusiasm. Personality-wise, he had a lot in common with the young Tom Kalinske, but where Kalinske used those gifts publicly to sway the masses, Fisher preferred to operate behind the scenes. That's part of the reason he loved these off-the-books meetings with Sega of America's president. Normally, the two of them swapped pieces of information with the excitement of kids trading baseball cards, and that was how it had started today, until Kalinske interrupted the typical haggling session by asking for Fisher's most valuable card. "What's wrong with Sega of Japan?" Fisher repeated to himself. For a moment, he politely tried to avoid laughing at the inquiry, but ultimately couldn't stop himself from cracking up. "Jeez, Tom," he replied, rogue giggle slipping out between his words. "How on earth were you able to sneak such a loaded question past those goons at airport security?" "All right," Kalinske admitted. "I suppose I should have toned it down a notch or two. But then again, isn't the whole beauty of our breakfasts together supposed to be that we get to stop playing politics for 15 minutes? "This is true," Fisher replied with a nod so earnest it made the cup of coffee in his hand bob. "Plus, for me, there's the added joy of, you know, actually getting to speak in my native tongue. Oh, English, how I've missed thee." Fisher had been missing the idiosyncrasies of English since 1988. After graduating from a small engineering college, he yearned for something bigger. So he sold his Honda scooter and Cannondale mountain bike to buy a one-way ticket to Japan. For 2 years, he bounced around the country teaching English before getting a job in Sega's expanding consumer department. The company was becoming serious about growing their business abroad, so Nakayama wanted to bring in a crop of young non-Japanese go-getters to help facilitate that growth. After proving himself to be the most capable of these new recruits, Fisher was promoted to manage communications between the parent company and Sega's subsidiary in America. Like many of his colleagues at SOJ, Fisher didn't have particularly high hopes for SOA, but his barometer was reset when Tom Kalinske took over a few months later. Few outside the toy industry had ever heard of Kalinske, but by a strange stroke of coincidence, Mike Fisher happened to be in this exclusive minority. In college, Fisher had written his thesis on the econometrics of the modern toy industry, which basically meant he spent his senior year studying the innovative strategies of Steven Hassenfeld, Hasbro, Bruce L. Stein, Kenner, and of course, Tom Kalinske, Mattel. Through this research, Fisher knew better than anyone what Sega was getting in Kalinske, and from that moment forward, made a commitment to ensure that Sega of America's new CEO was given every opportunity to succeed. Make no mistake, He was first and foremost loyal to Sega of Japan, but he sincerely believed that what was best for SOA was best for SOJ, and so he had no reservations about stacking the deck when necessary. Sometimes that meant dropping hints about games in development. Sometimes that meant simply warning SOA when Nakayama was in a bad mood. And other times, like today, it meant meeting Kalinske for breakfast to make sure that he entered the apiary with the right kind of bee suit. "Fine, fine," Fisher replied playfully. "Let's have an honest discussion. Rid yourself of the weight of that golden crown, and I'll set aside this pesky jester's hat. What is it specifically that you'd like to know?" "Mike, I've been with Sega for over 2 years now," Kalinske said. "I honestly could not be happier with the work that our team has done. We've really started to turn this thing around. But I get the strange feeling that the more successful we are in America, the less pleased they are in Japan."
"That's ridiculous," Fisher exclaimed.
"Is it?" Kalinske asked sincerely.
"No, it's not ridiculous," Fisher admitted.
"But it should be ridiculous."
"I know,"
Kalinske said, shaking his head. A sad, strange silence followed, which both men chose to fill by picking at their omelets. "So what's the problem here?" Kalinske said finally. "Is it jealousy? We have 50% of the market and they have less than 15%?
"I'd like to pause for a moment to remind you that I am one of they."
"Yes," Kalinske said, "but whatever this attitude is, I feel it from you too."
Fisher considered. "I don't think jealousy is the right word."
"Then tell me what the right word is."
The younger man thought about this for a little while. "When I was a kid," he began, "there were a few times when I wanted to do something. Something that seemed completely harmless, but for whatever reason my parents wouldn't let me do it. I would ask them why not. Why couldn't I go play football with the neighbors? Or why couldn't I sleep over at this friend's house? And the only explanation they provided was, because I'm the parent and you're the child."
"My parents used to say the same thing," Kalinske added.
"So you understand then?"
"No, I still don't. Because even though my parents said that, they never arbitrarily changed the date of Sonic Tuesday. Nor did they ignore faxes, fail to return phone calls, and turn up their nose at my marketing plans even though their own were simply not working."
"Your parents had marketing plans?" Fisher joked.
Kalinske sighed and glanced toward the lobby for any sign of Nilsson or Toyota. They had flown with him to Japan, Nilsson as part of his new job responsibilities, and Toyota to help Kalinske pitch the joint hardware venture with Sony. They'd head over to SOJ together, but Nilsson and Toyota must still have been upstairs getting ready.
"Who came with you?" Fisher asked. "Shinobu and Paul?"
Kalinske shook his head. "Shinobu and Al."
"Ah, Al. How is he enjoying the promotion?"
"Too early to say," Kalinske answered. Following the success of Sonic Tuesday, Nilsson became SOA's Group Director of Global Marketing, a new position created for the dual purposes of allowing him to continue to think big, but now on a global scale, and encouraging him to serve as something of a marketing liaison between America, Europe, and Japan. Plus, in light of the growing fragility in relations between America and Japan, it seemed like a critical time to have someone Kalinske trusted carrying the world on his shoulders. With Nilsson now bouncing from country to country, Diane Adair was promoted to take over marketing for the Genesis. The timing of the shakeup also fit nicely with SOA's plans to double in size by the end of 1993. Although Nilsson had done an excellent job managing his team for Sonic Tuesday, there was no denying the unique physics of Nilsson's approach to marketing, and Kalinske wanted him to keep thinking bigger and not sweating the small stuff. Which worked out nicely, because Adair's meticulous style and teacher-like sensibility were well-suited to reorganize the marketing department and bring new blood into the fold. And while Kalinske knew that it would be weird not to have Nilsson around the office as much as before, the potential of his replicating the magic of Sonic Tuesday was too great to ignore. It was time to take the genie out of the bottle.
"We'll see," Kalinske said.
"But I'm sincerely hoping that Al can teach Japan's marketing team a thing or two about what a goldmine Sonic can be for them."
"He better," Fisher replied. "We need the money to pay the sea people, don't we?"
"Don't even get me started," Kalinske said with a roll of the eye.
One of Goodby's latest ads, which satirized those grainy Jacques Cousteau films, looked and felt like all those Ocean Explorer videos, except in the Sega commercial, everyone on the crew was crammed in a room playing Echo the Dolphin. It was a great spot. It totally captured the Sega spirit, but also captured the attention of the Cousteau Society, which was suing Sega and Goodby for $3 million. "I hope they use the money to buy a sense of humor," Kalinske said with a cadence indicating he was just about ready to leave.
"Hey," Fisher said, suddenly smiling at some kind of memory. "Did I ever tell you where the idea of the hedgehog came from?"
"I thought it was the mascot contest," Kalinske guessed.
"Well, yes, but where the idea for the contest came from?"
"I don't believe so." Fisher leaned in.
"This is one of my favorite stories. Nakasan gets all the credit because he designed the game and, you know, he's this powerful personality. But because of that, I think Oshima-san gets lost in the shuffle. So, one time I went up to him and asked Sonic's true creator where that spark of an idea had come from. He's really shy, this unassuming kid, and I expected him to say something like, 'It was a team effort,' or 'It was just one of those things.' But he smiles really small and he says, 'I just put Felix the Cat on the body of Mickey Mouse.'"
"Oh, come on," Kalinske said. "That can't be true."
"It is, I swear," Fisher chortled. "And as shocked as you are to find this out, Oshima-san is more shocked that nobody ever called him out on this."
After the two men laughed about how their lives had changed because of a twice-plagiarized creation, Fisher looked at his watch and adopted a less frivolous tone.
"Look, I don't think that consistently being wrong inherently makes someone right. But I'm curious why you are asking me this now. The examples you mentioned, Sonic Tuesday aside, have been the case for some time, no?"
It was a good question, and Kalinske could choose to answer it with varying degrees of frankness. "I'm asking," Kalinske said with some coyness, "because I want to ask SOJ to do something, and I need them to say yes." Fisher nodded. "I assume that if you wanted to give me any more information, you would have, so I won't ask. But it's hard for me to advise you on this without knowing what you have in mind." Kalinske looked across the table and considered how much to reveal. It seemed only fair to fill him in, since Fisher had been so forthcoming over the years. After all, Fisher had been the one who would tell him what Nakayama had to say about SOA after Kalinske left the room, and also the ones who told him which days Nakayama was angry and carrying a golf club around the office like Al Capone with a baseball bat.
"I want us to work with Sony," Kalinske said quietly, "on a next-generation console."
Fisher was momentarily taken aback, but very quickly the idea sank in. It made a lot of sense.
"How far along is this?"
"The guys who did the hardware for that failed Nintendo venture are working out of Sony Music now. With assistance from Olaf and Mickey, we seem to have their approval. Now it's our turn."
"What does Joe Miller have to say about the specs?"
"Nothing yet," Kalinske said with a wave of his hand. "We're keeping this one close to the vest until it becomes real." Fisher nodded, his cheeks flushed with enthusiasm.
"This could be huge, Tom."
"Exactly."
"We split the R&D, Fisher said, speaking softly to himself. "Use their manufacturing capabilities, combine our distribution networks, and crush Nintendo," Kalinske finished in a whisper.
"That seems highly likely," Fisher agreed.
"And I have to imagine that my colleagues over here will see this as our best chance of finally getting a bigger share of the Japanese market."
"Yes, well, I'd like to do more than imagine," Kalinske said. "I want to make sure that politics don't get in the way of this."
"Me too,"
Fisher agreed, racking his brain for suggestions.
"Well, as you know, Sato's team has already made great strides on a 32-bit system. So whether it's true or not, make sure that Sato doesn't feel like he's wasted his time. You know, tell him that Sony wants to defer to Sega's expertise. It might also be worth appealing to the arcade guys so they can keep R&D excited on the software front."
"Got it," Kalinske said, mentally revising his plans for the day. "But what about Nakayama-san? Do you think he understands everything that we're doing in America? Hope he doesn't think we're too crazy."
"Are you serious?"
Fisher asked, practically doing a double take. Kalinske was so intuitive in so many ways, but for some reason he failed to see how Nakayama really felt about him.
Tom, Nakayama trusts you more than he trusts his own staff.
Kalinske shook his head. That can't be right.
Wait, you really didn't know that?
We have a good relationship, I suppose, but I never quite know where I stand.
You should. You're at the top, Fisher replied. I mean, just last week we were in the boardroom and the producers were presenting games to Nakayama-san. After every presentation, his first question was, what does Tom think? He had no interest unless you had some interest.
Kalinske didn't respond, but Fisher could tell that he was rather flabbergasted, and Fisher was flabbergasted that Kalinske didn't know this already.
Hey, Fisher said. Remember how earlier I told you that my folks used to say, we're the parents and you're the child?
Yeah.
Well, now that I think about it a little more, I'm realizing that was the wrong parental analogy. The real problem is that Mom and Dad like you the best, and your siblings are a little sick of hearing about their favorite son.
Fragments from the conversation with Fisher rattled around Kalinske's mind as he, Nilsson, and Toyota were given a tour of Sega's Japanese R&D lab. This was always one of the best parts of visiting SOJ, the part that felt a bit like rushing toward a just-smashed pinata, but on recent trips there seemed to be fewer pieces of candy inside.
Is it just me? Kalinske whispered to Nilsson and Toyota as their host stepped several paces ahead. Are they showing us less and less these days?
Toyota shrugged, but Nilsson had an answer.
Both, actually.
Kalinske looked puzzled at this response.
How can it be both?
Nilsson quickly glanced over his shoulder and then explained that what SOJ presented changed with each visitor. So when the CEO of SOA was in town, they only wanted to show off the very best, hiding anything that might get nixed in its developmental phase.
Kalinske lightly shook his head.
Well, that's kind of dumb, don't you think?
Don't worry, Nilsson added. They'll show me the real stuff later today and I'll report back to you guys.
Before Kalinske could muster up what would surely be a sarcastic response, Nakayama arrived to greet the team from Sega of America. After trading formalities, they resumed the R&D team's tour. As they did, Nakayama lingered a few steps behind the group from America, more interested in observing their reactions to the products than in the products themselves. The item that Sega's R&D team appeared to be most excited about landed somewhere on the spectrum between hardware and peripherals. It was a 32-bit upgrade for the Genesis, something that connected to the 16-bit console and made it twice as powerful.
Would it play the regular Genesis cartridges?
Kalinske wondered. Or would this require a different type of software? The R&D team proudly explained that it would require new and much more powerful software to play in 32 bits. But, most important, Sega would be the first company to reach the next frontier, as they'd done with 16 bits. Rarely did Sega of Japan's employees smile, but in this case they did, which made it that much more awkward when Kalinske, Nilsson, and Toyota offered little more than a thanks-anyway smile. The idea of a supercharged add-on was fine. That's essentially what the Sega CD was, after all. But if they were going to make a 32-bit system, then they might as well just make a new console and not just use the old one as little more than a battery. Kalinske could feel the waves of subtle resentment emanating from the SOJ research team. But better to endure that than head down a multi-million-dollar rabbit hole that would lead nowhere. But that negative sentiment immediately evaporated when Kalinske was shown the Pico, a lunchbox-sized, plastic-coated portable device that would be released in Japan during the summer of 1993. The Pico looked like a colorful cross between a storybook, a Game Gear, and an Etch-a-Sketch. It came equipped with a magic pen that allowed children to enter the world of their entertainment. Much the way he'd felt when he first saw the Genesis, Kalinske was absolutely blown away by the potential of what this could become. It was the edutainment machine that Sega had been working on, a portable computer for kids that would demonstrate the educational power of video games while stealing away Nintendo's youngest demographic in the process. It was a marvelous intersection of education, entertainment, technology, and storytelling. And for a moment, Kalinske was tempted to say, "Who cares about next-generation video games? Let's just do this and do it right." But then he remembered that he didn't have to choose just one thing. He'd built a company with enough resources to let him do all these wonderful things at once. And so after congratulating Sega's R&D team, he made a comment that he hoped would be prophetic. "If you can make this cheap enough to sell for $100," Kalinske declared, "then I promise you this will be the number one toy of the year." The creators of the device blushed at these words, and Nakayama smiled like a truffle hunter whose pig had just sniffed out a big find. As they all excitedly discussed constructive tweaks to the Pico, members of SOJ's marketing team came to whisk Nilsson away. "Duty calls," Nilsson explained, but on his way out he made sure to pass Kalinske and whisper prophetic words of his own. "We cannot bring over that 32-bit thing," he cautioned. "It just can't happen." "I know," Kalinske said, bidding farewell to his new global marketing guru. After Nilsson left, the rest of the day was spent in a series of meetings, more friendly than functional, until Kalinske and Toyota finally discussed the Sony possibility with Nakayama and a few of his top lieutenants. Among that group was Hideki Sato, who had been Sega's director and deputy general manager of R&D since 1989, when his team brilliantly refashioned Sega's System 16 arcade board into the Mega Drive. Although Nakayama would have final approval on how Sega proceeded, it would be Sato's reaction that would inform his decision. Knowing this and following Fisher's advice, Kalinske carefully proposed the idea of working with Sony in a complementary manner, and highlighted that this would not sacrifice any of the great work that Sato's team had already done on the next generation of hardware. The reaction to the joint venture was mixed at best. Although those from Sega of Japan saw some business sense in a joint venture, they appeared to be fundamentally resistant to the idea. Whether this mentality was spurred by corporate pride, "we don't need them," creative ownership, "we want to do this our way," or competitive skepticism, "Sony just wants to see what we've got and steal it," Kalinske was not sure, but this certainly wasn't shaping up to be the no-brainer that he'd been hoping it would be. But, true to Fisher's words, Nakayama seemed to trust Kalinske more than his own staff. Unlike in the boardroom 2 years ago, Kalinske wasn't given carte blanche to run with this opportunity, but Nakayama wanted Sega to very seriously explore this option and form a review team to work with Sony over the next several months. If Kalinske was right, and this was a golden opportunity, then that would become evident and a wonderful partnership would be formed. But if he was wrong, then Sega had no obligation to continue working with Sony and could continue forward on their own. Sato and the other members of R&D seemed to appreciate this resolution and harbored no noticeable ill will about moving forward in this fashion. For Kalinske, it wasn't quite a win, but given the initial feedback, it was more than he'd been expecting. Plus, he was rather certain that this really was a golden opportunity, so getting the win was just a matter of time. To celebrate this and Sega's other successes, Kalinske went out with Nakayama to the same geisha club that they had visited a couple of years earlier. Among the girlish giggles and swoops of sake, it was hard not to appreciate how far they had come together, and there was still so much further they could go together, a prospect that Kalinske was now more confident and excited after that day's events. Between the Pico, the partnership with Sony, and Nilsson's acceptance of a role as global marketing ambassador, Kalinske couldn't help but feel a hint of guilt for ever doubting Nakayama and those at Sega of Japan. They had their differences, and certainly their occasional doubts about each other, but at the end of the day they were all part of the same family, and mutual success would make that family a big happy one. Kalinske had decided to stop wondering what was wrong with Sega of Japan, but now Nilsson couldn't get the question out of his mind. Unlike his boss, Nilsson's query wasn't inspired by frustration so much as it was by genuine curiosity about why Sega of America and Sega of Japan had experienced such differing levels of success. They both had the same products, the same games, and the same blue hedgehog, yet with the smaller budget, SOA had 50% of the American market, whereas SOJ only had 15% of the Japanese market. The easiest conclusion to reach might be that SOJ's personnel simply lacked the talent to execute, but Nilsson had spent enough time with them to know that such an assumption was heinously incorrect. The producers were virtuosos, the R&D team was relentless, and the executives were as sharp as anyone at SOA. The second easiest conclusion to reach might be that they were just lazy, that they had the right people and the right products, but simply didn't care enough to go sweep a nation. But Nilsen knew this was also terribly false. Everyone he knew at SOJ worked around the clock, paid attention to the tiniest of details, and bled Sega blue. So then what accounted for the large disparity between SOA and SOJ? Cultural tastes? Vastly different market conditions? Nintendo's parent company in Japan was that much more formidable than Arakawa's group in America? Nilsen didn't know the answer. But he was happy to stop thinking about it for a little while when he went out to dinner with some members from SOJ's marketing team. Nilsen and about 5 junior executives, who in Japan are called salarymen, left the office together, happily sharing stories as they hit the streets. They walked for about 5 minutes toward a bustling alley with a hypnotic mix of neon signs and blinking electronic stores, before the salarymen started pointing and laughing at a restaurant on the second floor. Usually they spoke in English, or tried their best to communicate with gestures, but Nilsen had no idea what was going on, until a few minutes later, when he was sitting on the floor of a private room in a dimly lit restaurant. Nilsen began looking through the menu until one of the salarymen pulled it away. They came here often, it seemed, and they would take care of all the details for their friend from America. After a long flight and a taxing day, Nilsen was more than happy to defer to his hosts for the evening, until he detected a few subtle scuffs of laughter when the food order was placed. Something was going on. And given the unusual delicacies of Japan, it was likely something weird. Octopus, starfish, bottlenose, dolphin. Although none of these species got Nilsen's mouth watering, he was an adventurous eater and a team player. So as long as whatever they ordered for him wasn't breathing, he figured that he'd find a way to get it down. But when the food arrived, his suspicions were confirmed. There was more at stake here than just stomaching the unknown. Fugu. That's what they'd ordered for him, and only him. As the dish was placed in front of Nilsen, the salaryman explained that this was a Japanese pufferfish. But unlike other creatures in the sea, raw fugu was lethally poisonous due to its heightened levels of tetrodotoxin. For this reason, it could be prepared only by qualified chefs who had undergone rigorous training. Even so, it was not a perfect science, and eating fugu resulted in about 50 illnesses and 10 deaths each year. With thin, sashimi-style slices of this possibly toxic dish sitting in front of him, Nilsen joined in the titillation of laughter around the table. "How do you think my parents will feel," Nilsen asked, "when they find out their son was killed by a pufferfish?" The laughter reached a crescendo, but all eyes remained fixed on Nilsen. Did he have the courage to tempt fate and eat the fugu on his plate? Or was he just another foolish gaijin passing through the land of the rising sun? The expression in their eyes told Nilsen that they were very much wishing for the latter, granting them license to laugh at him and not with him. But to their dismay, he lifted a pair of chopsticks. Then, without hesitation, Nilsen picked up a slice of the treacherous fish and took a bite. Not bad. Not bad at all. Amidst gasps from the salarymen, he took another bite, and then another one after that. It's actually very bland, Nilsen said, but received no response because the men from Sega of Japan were speechless with shock. After another bite, Nilsen pushed the plate forward and asked, "Who wants to try a piece?" He scanned the table, and as he made eye contact with each one, they physically recoiled at the challenge, their laughter gone and replaced with sudden dread. "Come on," Nilsen implored. "There must be someone willing to take the risk." There were only 10 deaths each year. 10 out of hundreds of thousands, and besides, there was a hospital down the street. Nothing bad was going to happen, so it was worth trying at least one bite. But the fear in their eyes said otherwise. And that's when Nilsen finally realized the fundamental difference between Sega of America and Sega of Japan. They weren't willing to take the risk, to race Sonic against Mario or welcome a generation to the next level. These people were highly talented and certainly not lazy, but deep down, they weren't as interested in winning as they were in not losing.
Without risk, there is no reward. And so Nilsson lifted his chopsticks and pulled the plate toward him, proudly eating every last piece of the pufferfish all by himself. Chapter 42. Barbarians at the Gate. Going into Christmas 1992, Nintendo was experiencing the same problem facing many a gawky, pimple-populated teenager. They just weren't cool. And like that dateless teenager doing typically cool things like trying out for the football team or buying a baseball team, only seemed to make things worse. The primary reason for this was Sega, whose speedy, snarky, Welcome to the Next Level campaign had, by contrast, branded Nintendo with the dreaded Scarlet U, uncool, unhip, unfit for anyone older than 10. Given the prevalence of these ads and the pop cultural chord they had struck, Nintendo's employees were well aware of the tectonic shift in perception. But if any of them had been holding out hope that Sega was merely a passing fancy, that notion went out the window following a presentation from Market Data Corporation, MDC. "Slowing growth," the representative from MDC said for what seemed like the 100th time. "The recession, of course, accounts for some of that slowing growth, but our investigation reveals other factors at play." Earlier in the year, when the tide had really begun to turn, NOA had commissioned MDC to study the changing landscape of the video game industry. In the course of their research, they spent time with nearly 800 families, studying the habits of video game players in much the same way that Goodby, Berlin, and Silverstein's account planners had done not too long ago. "Kids who own a Nintendo console still play a good deal," the representative continued. "About 2.3 hours per day, actually, based on the individuals included in our sample. But among those we surveyed, they described the interaction as less involved. This increasing apathy can also be used to explain the..." "Let me guess," Peter Main interrupted. "Slowing growth?" "Yes," the representative answered over a chirping of chuckles, evidently unashamed of his apparent predictability. "And the response we kept hearing over and over to explain the aforementioned sentiment of apathy is that playing Nintendo is simply, quote-unquote, not cool anymore."
"Hey, I have an idea," Bill White interjected. "Maybe we should throw in a pair of sunglasses with every Super Nintendo bundle."
After another flurry of giggles, the representative continued. "We asked each of our interview subjects to rate each console currently available at retail in a variety of areas. Sega ranked highest in the majority of categories, including image, value, and technology," he explained. "But Nintendo scored highest in terms of fun, excitement, and game selection."
Arakawa nodded at this, not because it was an acceptable silver lining, but because to him, it was the only lining that really mattered. Gameplay was everything, all the rest was just noise. Had he voiced this sentiment, nobody in the room would have objected to his logic, but where they likely would have disagreed was on the importance of the so-called noise. Years ago, Peter Main had coined the slogan, "The name of the game is the game," and he still felt that to be true. But there was no denying that Sega's sizzle had changed the rules of the game. And the biggest change, at least from Nintendo's perspective, was that Sega had turned this into a war of style versus substance. To anyone vaguely familiar with the video game industry, there appeared to be no reason that Nintendo couldn't match Sega's style punch for punch. In fact, it baffled many that Nintendo had yet to publicly respond to Sega's jabs. After all, they had the personnel, the products, and the financial resources to redefine, or at least refurbish, the Nintendo brand for a new generation. This didn't have to mean shooting edgy Sega-like commercials, advertising during prime time, or promising the next level. But Nintendo could have crafted a campaign that reminded the world of all the fun that this level had to offer. Or they could have developed a speedy Sonic Killer game, in the same way that Sega had once upon a time created a Mario Killer. Or if Nintendo planned to stick with Mario, they could have slightly modernized his look. Back in 1990, they had given him a nose job to make him look less stereotypically Italian. Why not now equip him with torn jeans or a flaming plunger? The point was that Sega had painted Nintendo into a corner, but there were a million ways they could have tried to escape this fate. For another example, they can market Mario Paint, an innovative art game that came with a computer-like mouse, as a high-tech art program and not a family-friendly color-by-numbers package. As Nintendo's market share dwindled, it became easy to offer up criticisms like these, but there was one major reason Nintendo didn't directly respond to how Sega had chosen to portray them. Sega was pretty much spot on. Nintendo really was the video game equivalent of Disney. Not just with cute characters and squeaky clean family values, but also with that magical sense of nostalgia that even children can feel. And just like Disney and Mickey Mouse, Nintendo and Mario were uncool in exactly the same way. Because they weren't supposed to be cool. They were supposed to be fun, timeless, and magical. And with those great strengths came the great weakness of appealing to teens and young adults. If Nintendo preferred to remain as is, they would continue to concede this growing portion of the market. But if they wanted to evolve, they risked losing their identity. As a result, Nintendo was faced with a simple proposition: acceptance or adaptation. "Our research is by no means conclusive," said the Market Data Corporation's bearer of bad news. "But if nothing else, it indicates that Nintendo needs to implement new strategies to retain a dominant position in the market." Although this comment reeked of obviousness, those present listened with a show of thoughtfulness. They did so because each had a slightly different perspective on how Nintendo should progress, and each was secretly hoping that this would be the moment when everyone else in the room realized that they'd been right all along. Arakawa, naturally, wanted to stay the course. Tilden generally agreed, but thought that more could be done to spruce up the brand and take advantage of Nintendo's iconic intellectual properties. Main agreed with Tilden in tone, but was more concerned with size. He believed that the video game industry was becoming more and more like the film industry, and he wanted to go bigger and bolder for the launches of Nintendo's blockbuster titles. The advertising guys from Leo Burnett wanted to reinvent the wheel, because that's what advertising guys always want to do. And last but not least, White didn't want to respond to Sega, per se. Rather, he preferred to do what they were doing, but do it even better. He wanted Nintendo to aggressively evolve and become more like Sega, believing that there was no better proof of the market's changing taste than a look at the company's best-selling games in 1992. 1. Street Fighter II, 1,300,000. 2. Legend of Zelda, 1 million. 3. Super Mario Kart, 550,000. 4. Mario Paint, 550,000. 5. Turtles 4, 350,000. 5. Madden Football, 350,000. 6. NCAA Basketball, 250,000. 7. Play Action Football, 250,000. 8. Super Star Wars, 150,000. 9. NHLPA Hockey, 150,000. Nintendo's top title of 1992 was a fighting game. And although there was no blood or gore on it, there was nothing Disney-esque about Ryu's Hadouken or E. Honda's 100-hand slap. And of those top 10 games, only 5 were first-party titles, indicating that other companies were better at capitalizing on consumer tastes, and 4 of them were sports titles, which Nintendo had typically shied away from, but this year lucked out on because they had finally been able to make a deal with Electronic Arts after Trip Hawkins abruptly left the company. And beyond the games, the effectiveness of Sega's advertising served as further proof that fresh marketing was critical to continued success, and watching any sporting event was a reminder that even market leaders like McDonald's and Coca-Cola were constantly reinventing themselves. "Come on," White thought exasperatedly. Sega had just pulled even with Nintendo. If ever there was a moment to pull out the big guns, now was it. From an urgency standpoint, White may have been correct. But unfortunately for him, the stars just weren't aligned for a big change at this time. Had it been 2 years earlier, pre-launch, or 2 years later, toward the end of the console's life cycle, Nintendo would have been more likely to roll the dice. But as they headed into 1993, there was just too much at stake. Sega had not only swiped away a large portion of Nintendo's market share, but also had proven that there was room for more than one in the console business. And now that the precedent had been set, the barbarians were lined up at the gate, and five reputable hardware makers lurked on the horizon. 1. 3DO. A sleek, sophisticated 32-bit system that planned to be more than just a console. With the tagline proclaiming it to be